Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and culture stories. I am Netta Ulibi. As always, you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week on NPR's Arts Channel, after 5 decades on the air, As the World Turns will come to a halt. We look at why we don't watch soap operas anymore. Author Jonathan Franzen has gotten so much acclaim for his new novel, Freedom, some are suggesting it's because of his gender. And a fresh listen to Freddie Mercury, Queen's legendary frontman, as part of our 50 Great Voices series. But first,
Hollywood is forever dreaming up futures, from Metropolis, back in the silent film era, to the Terminator movies, to a remake of Soylent Green that's now on the drawing boards. Bob Mondello was looking at the calendar, and he's noticed that a lot of those futures are nearing their expiration dates.
The future is past, or at any rate, the future novelists and Hollywood screenwriters imagined for me in my youth is past.
No 9,000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information. We are all, by any practical definition of the words, foolproof and incapable of error.
Growing up in the 1960s, my friends and I were as thrilled by the talking computer in 2001 A Space Odyssey as we were terrified by 1984's totalitarian Big Brother. George Orwell had told us that 1984 would bring brainwashing. Arthur C. Clarke countered that in 2001 we'd have mind expansion. Back when I was a kid, it never occurred to me that I'd actually live through those years. But here we are. Big Brother is a TV show. And the year 2001's mind-expanding breakthrough was what? Shrek?
Onions have layers. Ogres have layers. We both have layers.
So much for 60s crystal ball gazing. A generation later, 80s screenwriters gave us a whole new set of visions. Machines run amok in Blade Runner and Terminator. Skateboards without wheels in the Back to the Future movies.
Little girl, stop. I need to borrow your hoverboard.
Those 80s futures, let's note, are now approaching their expiration dates. We're just 9 years away from Blade Runner's replicants, 5 from Doc Brown's Flying DeLorean, and Terminator? Well, the sequels have hedged a bit, but in the first two films, much of humanity was wiped out almost precisely 13 years ago.
3 billion human lives ended on August 29th, 1997. The survivors of the nuclear fire called the War Judgment Day.
Some of these once visionary visions now look pretty quaint. We're far enough along now to laugh at 2001's Space Odyssey when it shows a Pan Am moon shuttle with flight attendants serving zero-gravity meals, as if either Pan Am or in-flight snacks would still be around in the space age. Then again, some of the vision came true. Kubrick basically invented Skype for 2001, and he did it, remember, in 1968, so that a scientist could see his daughter when he talked to her from the space station.
Hello! How are you, Squirt? What are you doing?
No matter how accurate they may be, all fictional futures, especially alarmist ones, lose urgency as the concerns that fueled them fade. The Cold War paranoia of 1984 and 2001 now feel distant. Tech boom fears in Blade Runner a bit more current. This decade, we're uptight about the environment, so we get WALL-E. In the Flower Power era, we were skeptical about social conformity, so we got A Clockwork Orange.
Let's get it, boys!
Remember what Stanley Kubrick did in Clockwork to the super contemporary housing complex where most of the muggings and gang fights took place? It was the sort of elegant, clean-lined architecture that sociologists were claiming in 1971 would make abandoned inner cities livable again. Kubrick showed what those clean lines would look like after a decade or so of neglect, mucked up with graffiti and broken windows, a neat visual shorthand for the limits of social engineering. Kubrick is the same guy, remember, who had just made the future look so gorgeously pristine in 2001 A Space Odyssey. But as time catches up with fictional futures, the one thing you realize is that they're never as nuanced as real life. They're all either light or dark, utopias or dystopias. Logan's Run, for instance, posits a 23rd century where people have expiration dates. You live a rigidly structured, apparently mindless life for 3 decades, and then as your reward for hitting 30, you're disposed of. Just human garbage.
There's been a terrible error. nowhere near 30. I'm 22. No!
Undeniably downbeat, our great-great-great-great-great-great grandkids will never know the joys of a happy retirement. But all doom and gloom? Well, maybe for them, but if you're like me, you can still find a little cheer in even the direst of futures. In this case, I take comfort from the clothes. Judging from what everybody wears in Logan's Run, polyester is going to be very big in the 23rd century, so apparently we 21st century folks can stop worrying so much about running out of oil. I'm Bob Mandela.
Jonathan Franzen's new novel, Freedom, is garnering a waterfall of praise from the critics, so much praise that some other writers think it's over the top. They say it's evidence of a bias among the literary elite. NPR's Lynn Neary has the story.
Jonathan Franzen has a way of making people mad. When his last novel, The Corrections, was picked by Oprah Winfrey for her book club, Franzen made it known that he was not comfortable with this populist honor. Oprah withdrew the offer. This time around, a couple of best-selling women writers, Jodi Picoult and Jennifer Weiner, have tweeted their disdain for what they see as critical fawning over Franzen's new novel, Freedom. Weiner has even come up with a phrase to describe her feelings, Franzenfreude.
Schadenfreude is taking pleasure in the pain of others. Franzenfreude is taking pain in the multiple and copious reviews being showered on Jonathan Franzen.
Weiner says her angst is not just about the book or even about Franzen himself.
It's about the establishment choosing one writer and writing about him again and again and again and again and again, while they're ignoring a lot of other worthy writers and, in the case of the New York Times, entire genres of books.
Weiner's known for writing chick lit, which she thinks is just a snappier way of saying commercial women's fiction. And though she's done very well with the genre, she knows it's not a critical favorite. Weiner believes even literary novels by women do not get the same attention as a small group of men whose writing is taken very seriously by publications like the New York Times. But if you ask Sam Tenenhouse, editor of the New York Times Book Review, what criteria the publication uses to decide what to review, he'll tell you,
there are none.
Tenenhouse says the Times looks for books that will engage their readers and interest their reviewers. But Tenenhouse acknowledges the critical establishment does take certain kinds of books more seriously than others.
For us as editors, reviewers, and critics, what we're really trying to do is something that's probably impossible, but in our Panglossian optimism, we hope is maybe now and again achievable, and that's to identify that fiction that maybe really will endure.
In his review of Freedom, Tannenhaus declared the novel a masterpiece and compared Franzen to such literary greats as Leo Tolstoy and Thomas Mann. He believes Franzen deserves both the attention and the praise he's getting because he's that rare writer who tells us something about the secret life of the culture.
And so the extraordinary interest in Franzen derives from this, that he somehow seems to give you a panorama of the culture, but also tap into the deeper anxieties, tensions, and questions that animate us today. There are very few writers at any time who ever do this.
Tannenhaus says the interest in Franzen does not reflect any gender bias at the Times. He lists many well-known women writers the Times has reviewed recently. But Jennifer Weiner has her own list of male writers who she says are given a different kind of treatment in reviews.
It's just interesting to sort of stack them up against a Lori Moore or against a Mona Simpson, who write books about families that are seen as excellent books about families, and then to look at a Jonathan Franzen who writes a book about a family, but we're told this is a book about America. This is a book about the way we live now.
One woman writer who is regularly reviewed in the Times is Jane Smiley. Jonathan Franzen has cited her novel The Greenlanders as a book that has inspired him, so she admits to having a favorable opinion of the writer. But Smiley says she can understand why some women writers whose work is commercially successful but critically ignored would be frustrated.
Chick lit is no longer chick lit. There's an aspect of fiction now that's being written by women that is really smart, really daring in terms of the subject matter that it takes on, and really popular. And I think it's been overlooked because it's so straightforward. and because the payoff is emotional rather than intellectual.
In the end, says Smiley, it's not the critics who anoint the writers who will endure, it's the readers.
And whether the media elite in New York know who's really, really anointed or not, we'll never know.
And if it is the readers who decide, it should be noted, most readers of fiction are women. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
I'm Audie Cornish, and I have a confession. I'm addicted to television soap operas. My favorite is General Hospital, and maintaining that addiction for the last 20 years hasn't been easy. These days, I'm down to reading transcripts on my BlackBerry. Now, most women have just given up. In the last 30 years, the number of soaps has dwindled from 18 to just 6. And one of these shows, As the World Turns, signs off next month after a 54-year run. Peter Brash is a veteran of the soapy small screen, and until last year, he was a staff writer for that show. Peter Brash, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me, why do you think soaps are dying?
Well, I think in large measure, I think soaps in general have become victims of their own success. The serialized format has spread out just about everywhere you look, you know, from reality TV to shows like Mad Men and The Sopranos and any talent show or reality show. It's all branded to hook you in to tune in tomorrow or next week.
Also, there are just fewer people at home to watch.
Oh, absolutely.
Or I should say fewer women at home.
Right. It was all about women. In fact, in years past, if a woman heard I was on a soap opera, oh, they'd be all over me. They'd want to know, what shows have you written? What characters? Oh, what are they like in real life? Oh, tell me the storylines. Oh, please. Now it goes over with a thud.
How much of an impact do you think that reality television has had on this medium in particular?
I think that was an especially difficult situation for soap operas. There's something about reality shows now that they're soap operas in themselves. They're just real.
Right. There's a leading man. There's often a vamp. There's often a turncoat kind of character.
Right.
Or
and it's always
a
as
villain.
Outrageous as the soaps are, too, and larger-than-life characters and the crazy goings-on. And
right, and right down to the catfights, I think.
Right. So, you know, the audience is savvy enough to know that they're watching one that's real. Oh, she's really pulling her hair, and oh, my God, she might hurt her. And the other one is staged. So which one becomes more compelling?
You left As the World Turns last year. What's your most unusual storyline?
Once I was responsible for having two naked people fall from a meteor shower, and they seem
That's
to
awesome.
Be...
That's awesome.
Yeah, they seem to be from another planet, and I ran around naked one summer in Salem. I probably should have told the audience right away that the mad scientist in town had just, you know, put them up in a rocket ship, and they really weren't aliens. It's always better if the audience is in on the joke in that way. But it was kind of fun to see this brother and sister, the Gemini twins, running around naked around Salem all summer.
And Peter, culturally, what kind of loss do you think this is to this landscape?
Well, you know, in a funny way, I don't really think it is a loss. It's not that soap operas are dying. It's that soap operas are kind of lending their DNA to the rest of the entertainment media world. And that includes dramatic and reality. So I don't think it's a dead medium. It's just morphing into different things.
Peter Brash was a staff writer on As the World Turns and the co-head writer on Days of Our Lives. He joined us from our New York bureau. Peter Brash, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This year on NPR, we're exploring 50 great voices, singers who've made their mark across the decades. Today, the voice of Freddie Mercury. The late singer is best known as the frontman for the 70s rock group Queen. And NPR's Shireen Marisol Meraji has our profile.
Mercury is an element that stays fluid when the temperature dips low or soars high. Mercury is the Roman messenger god, wings on his sandals, moving quickly from place to place. Freddie Mercury was the mercurial rock star who chose a stage name in perfect harmony with his voice. He wasn't always the unstoppable British glam rocker Freddie Mercury.
The name we selected for him is Farrell. That was his birth name.
That's Mercury's mother, Jer Bulsara, from the film Freddie Mercury, The Untold Story. Farrukh Bulsara was Parsi, a group with ties to ancient Persia, but both of his parents were from India. He was born on the East African island of Zanzibar, once a base for Persian Gulf traders.
In this very hospital, the government hospital Zanzibar, on the 5th of September 1946, Farrukh Bulsara first saw the dazzling light of the world.
The film was directed by Rudi Dolezal. He portrays Mercury as an artist who mastered his craft in the West, but came of age in the East.
Mustafa Ibrahim. For example, if you listen to a song like Mustafa, you think, I mean, this is very strange. I mean, what kind of cultural influences? Where does it come from? If you now know that Freddie was born in Zanzibar, then went to India, then came to London, which again was like a culture shock, then you sort of can see it's like a little bit of multiculturalism that was sort of combined in Freddie Mercury and the way he used his voice.
Freddie Mercury's voice was untrained and unpredictable, mercurial, throttling from an earthy baritone to a wild but heavenly tenor. Singer Adam Lambert spent hours upon hours listening to Queen, trying to figure out how Mercury did it so he could do it for his American Idol audition.
Mama just killed a man, put a gun against his head.
Freddie's voice it has such a texture to it. He kind of like grabs at everything. He squeezes it.
A virtual unknown before American Idol, Adam Lambert finished the season belting out We Are the Champions, taking Mercury's place beside Queen guitarist Brian May. But Lambert says no one can sing it quite like Freddie.
During We Are the Champions, there's that one part where he goes, "Of the world," and he holds that out for a really long time and it kind of like echoes off into the distance. You know what I'm talking about? Of the world. Instead of just being like open with like world and just singing it through an open throat, he kind of goes like world, like he squeezes it. Ah. And it's like, it gives it this like emotional intensity.
That squeeze gave Freddie Mercury the ability to hold a strong, forceful note that also trembled with vulnerability. Not quite vibrato, more like a shout on the verge of crumbling into a sob. The mercurial showman, Freddie Mercury could go from singing a ballad at a baby grand to high-stepping like a rock star, wielding a microphone that looked like it was just ripped from its base.
It was about the music, but he also really captivated the audience because he was so electric. That's why he's an icon, because you remembered what he did on stage. He had a presence. There's definitely something missing in today's music, in the scene. We don't have a lot of men on stage doing flamboyant or theatrical. We have a lot of female pop stars doing it, but where's that classic rock, pop showman?
Freddie Mercury's stage performance was humorous, camp, but he was very serious about entertaining the fans.
Freddie's Deos, they used to call him. Because he would do the Deo and all that kind of stuff, and the audience would do them straight back at him perfectly every time, and he was always quite amazed by that.
Jackie Smith met Mercury in 1982 after responding to a want ad for a Queen fan club manager. 28 years later, she still has the job. Smith always had a backstage pass to Queen stadium shows, but she preferred to watch Mercury from the stands.
The atmosphere was incredible out the front. There were, 120,000 people, I think, at the last show, which was Nebworth. And it was like you were still part of an intimate crowd. Because Freddie almost reached every single one of those people, even those right at the back. All we hear is Radio Gaga,
Radio Gugu, Radio Gaga. 240,000 hands in sync doing All We Need Is was like, oh my God.
Rudy Dolezal, director of Freddie Mercury, The Untold Story, adds that offstage, Mercury was humble and always put his voice before his ego.
I can tell you one thing about his voice, which I think is a unique story. We all know that Freddie Mercury had very strange teeth. And we would ask ourselves, well, a guy who is that rich, why didn't he change his teeth? And he was very afraid that if he would change his teeth, that his particular sound of how his voice sounded would go away. So his voice was more important to him than his looks. And I think that says a lot about the man.
The humble showman from the East and the West with a quicksilver voice. Freddie Mercury chose a stage name that represented who he was and how he sang. Shireen Marisol Meraji, NPR News.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulubi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.